The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
Welcome to you all. This is another live Clubland Q&A here at steinonline.com. It is my great privilege to be here. I am neither Mark Stein nor Laura Rosen-Cohen, but I still hope to treat you well over the next hour. Unless you like the abuse, we can try that too. Depends on your question. This is Andrew Lawton, Mark's, Canadian compatriot, but I tried to do Canadian and compatriot at the same time. So I sounded like Justin Trudeau trying to describe a water bottle, which is a deep cut reference that only the Canadians listening may get. But nevertheless, trying to keep somewhat familiar to all of you, I should probably do the time zones around the world. Now, I haven't guest hosted in a little while, so I'm a little rusty on this. And I know Laura Rosen-Cohen, when she's guest hosting, just skips the time zones altogether. But I'll try to look after you. My list is alphabetical. Let me do the list by time. All right. It is where I am, 3 Eastern time, 3:02 Eastern time specifically, in lovely southwestern Ontario, Canada. But it is 10 a.m. Wednesday morning in Rarotonga. It is in Kansas City, a nice 2:02 in the afternoon. Heading across the Atlantic to Dublin, it's 8:02, also 8:02 in London as well. Don't want to start too much of a... I don't want to reinstate the troubles because I left one of the time zones out. So I should do Belfast as well. Belfast, it's also 8:02 p.m. That makes it 9:02 in Algiers. And also 9:02 in Valletta, where I had the best pasta I've ever had from a restaurant there. And going ahead to, what else do we have? 10:02 p.m. tonight in Jerusalem, just after midnight in Baku and Tbilisi. And that brings it 5:02 Thursday morning in Tokyo. And also, I believe, Pyongyang, but I don't know if Stein Online is available in Pyongyang. I feel like they try to smuggle it over the border along with the South Korean soap operas, but they intercept the Stein Online broadcast first, which makes it 7:03 Thursday morning in Melbourne, and then in the Chatham Islands Thursday at 9:48 a.m., because I know you all love those quarter-hour time zones. But wherever it is, we are glad to have you aboard. I mentioned in passing a moment ago that I was on the Mark Stein crew. I know I did. I didn't mention it. I was going to mention it. I was just last week on the Mark Stein cruise, and we sailed the lovely Caribbean Sea. We started out in the less lovely Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It was all right, but not as nice as some of the other ports. And then we went to Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas, Ocho Rios, Jamaica. Where else did we go? Grand Cayman, Cayman Islands, and then I'm missing, Acosta Maya in Mexico, where one of our fellow cruise speakers, Samantha Smith, had strong-armed me into going to swim with the dolphins, which I had a great time doing. The dolphins, I don't think, had as good a time swimming with me, but nevertheless, they didn't have a say in the matter. And it was great. I mentioned Samantha Smith. We also had Anne McElhenney and Phelan McAleer, Tal and Coco Bachman. We had Conrad Black and his lovely wife, Lady Black, Barbara Emile Black, on the cruise. And I'm forgetting. Oh, Leilani Dowding, of course, was there. And it was an absolute blast. I know I met many of you Mark Stein Club members aboard the ship and at port, and I had the chance to sit down and dine with several of you. So if you were on that cruise, and Michelle Bachman, how could I forget Michelle Bachman? She is like my, she's been on all of the Mark Stein cruises, as have I. And it's always a delight to see her and her daughter, Caroline, and son-in-law, Zach. So If you were on the cruise, thanks so much, and it was a delight. If you were not on the cruise, you can get on to the next one, which we'll hopefully have some details about in the coming days and weeks. That's over at marksteincruise.com. But it was good. I enjoyed sitting down with Anne and Phelim and Mark on one show on the cruise, which was called The New Media. And this was obviously near and dear to my heart, given that I am someone who is a refugee from mainstream media. And I've now been I don't know if I'm making a name is appropriate, but I've certainly been passing my time in the new media world, doing my own show and editing a news organization in Canada called True North. And it was interesting talking about this with Anne and Phelim, who have not only upended the traditional media and traditional storytelling model in their own work, but they've done it in a very groundbreaking way. I mean, their trial reenactments of the Harvey Weinstein trial, of Kevin Spacey, and most recently of Mark's trial in D.C. with Michael Mann has been absolutely incredible. And they're telling stories that no one is telling. They're talking about perspectives no one is doing. And they're doing it in a way that just completely doesn't need the New York Times or The Guardian, because they can communicate to people directly. And that is what I find so absolutely fascinating about this. And we're going to see a heck of a lot more of that in the years to come, as people realize that the traditional media landscape simply is not working. Now, I want to get to all of your questions here, and if you disagree with something I tell someone in one question, you can also then jump in and try to rebut me later on. Now, I always say that I'm trying to not go too heavy on the Canadian content, but then every time I say that, people tend to respond by asking me to do the Canadian content. So the volume of Canadian content is very much up to you, although I see the first one here is Canadian content, so I'll get to that in a moment. Just let me refresh the moment here, refresh the screen, because I've lost my questions, if you can bear with me. There we go. My apologies for that. KD writes, I've been seeing lots of videos with Pierre Poilievre, and he is rather impressive, though I hate to get my hopes up. What are your thoughts on the man? So this is an interesting one. And just to put a bit of context, Pierre Poilievre is the apple-munching leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. Now, this video a few months ago went viral. He was in an apple orchard and some lefty reporter had approached him and was asking him just the... I should just pull the audio. I never know what's going to be asked, so I can't preemptively pull audio clips, I guess. But the questions were just absolutely insane. Because they're like, well, people say that you're taking a page out of the Trump playbook, the populist rhetoric, right wing this and left wing that. And the longer it goes on, Poilievre is just like sitting there just munching his apple, just swatting away this guy's, loaded questioning. And the thing that I found interesting about it was that that clip put Pierre Poilievre on the map for non-Canadians. It was in the US, it was in the UK, it was in Australia. I just saw this morning, Sky News in Australia had done some package on the man that's going to be the next prime minister, and they referred to Justin Trudeau as General Flake, which I found quite lovely, and they played that clip of Pierre Poilievre munching on the apple. But that is, I think, an interesting little bit of how Poilievre is appealing to a broader conservative landscape outside of his own country here. And the fascinating part for me was that here's a guy who's doing something that conservative politicians in Canada have not really done before, which is flipping the script on the mainstream media. And he's doing it very well. I actually, in the spring, started writing a biography of Pierre Poilievre for Sutherland House, which is the company that published my previous book on the Freedom Convoy. And that book, which is so far the first and only biography of which I'm aware of Pierre Poilievre, is going to be coming out in May. We just announced that I've actually been just going through the illustrious task of like trying to find all the misplaced commas and typos that I didn't catch in like the first seven times reading through the manuscript. So we're hopefully getting it off to the print. Actually, I think we're getting it off to the printers tomorrow. So that is going to be coming out. But to your point, KD, about whether he is impressive, It's going to depend. I mean, he is not in a lot of ways a culture warrior. Well, I'll backtrack on that. I think he is a culture warrior, and he's very aware of where the grassroots of the Canadian conservative movement are. He's very timid on some issues. I think one example of this is on gender stuff. He's been very hesitant to wade into some of the trans stuff and the parental rights stuff. And it's really been waiting to see how these debates unfold before he comes in. But when he has spoken out about these issues, he's been immensely clear. I think it was 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, he was doing a press conference and someone asked him, David Menzies of Rebel News asked him, will you ban transgender people from single-sex spaces? And he was very unequivocal. He said, female spaces are for biological females, not biological males. And, I mean, that's such a low bar. It's such a low bar that you could have to clear. But in the current political discourse, that's actually a very difficult bar to expect a conservative leader to bound over. And he did it, and he landed on both feet and was rather unrepentant when the media was trying to say it was all, you know, hateful, transphobic, and bigoted, and all that sort of stuff. So I think in that sense, it was quite important to see him take the position that he did. And there have been other things where he's just been absolutely on the front lines of it. I mean, on fiscal issues, he was the only one talking about inflation when the Bank of Canada governor and all of the official sources were just downplaying it and saying, oh, no, it's no biggie. It's all transitory. And he was like trying to sound the alarm. He was talking about this ticking debt bomb, which no one was listening to. This is going back to, you know, what, 2017, 2018. And certainly over the course of the pandemic. So I think he's a unique figure. It was certainly fun writing a biography about him, and I hope that even non-Canadians might be able to enjoy that when it comes out in May. Elisa Angel writes, Andrew, would you please explain why the Canadian government is pushing MAID as much as it seemingly is? Has something triggered the desire to grow that program? This is, so MAID, just to put this in context here. MAID is the new euphemism for what we used to call assisted suicide. It's the new euphemism, MAID, medical assistance in dying. And MAID sounds, you know, lovely and benign and simple. It's supposed to be just so easy because MAID, it's not assisted dying, it's not euthanasia, it's not doctor assisted suicide, it's medical assistance in dying. And in Canada and the U.S., we used to look at Europe and see Europe as being, and certain countries like Switzerland and the Netherlands, as being these places that had this culture of death. It was the dynamic that you saw overseas, and you say, well, we're not like that here, thankfully. But it's changed a lot in recent years, and Canada has a culture of death, which is quite disgraceful. Canada has quickly become, or is quickly becoming, one of the world capitals, if not the world capital, of so-called MAID. You look at the MAID numbers in a place like California, and you compare them to Canada, and it looks on paper like Canadians are dying left, right, and center, and one of the leading causes of death is the state. And there have been so many examples of this, and I think I've spoken about them in the past on the Q&As, but where people will call up a government hotline in Canada because they need something. They need support for housing. They need a chairlift because they're in a wheelchair. They need to know where their Veterans Affairs check is. And the government, instead of offering them the help that they have sought, will offer them assisted suicide. And if you think I'm being hyperbolic here, just look at some of the body of stories that have been done on this. People that literally have not wanted to die, are not seeking death, are not suffering from any terminal condition, that are trying to get help, and the government is saying, well, I can't necessarily do that, but how about we kill you instead? Because this is, in the Canadian government's twisted view, thought of as being some proactive healthcare measure. Death is now a form of healthcare in Canada. And how do you deal with a society that has decided to embrace that? How do you even deal with it? Do you even deal with it? It is a, I was going to say a terminal culture, but I mean that both literally and figuratively in this context. Now, when I talk about this issue, I should also point out the context here that the Canadian government is expanding quite significantly the criteria by which you could apply and be eligible for MAID. And one of the big changes, and this one is near and dear to my heart as someone who has grappled with mental illness and suicide in the past, one of the changes is that you will not be even required to have a physical ailment. You could just have a mental illness. You could just have depression or schizophrenia. Like, just think about that for a moment. You could have some mental illness where a desire to end your life is a symptom of a mental illness, and that would meet the legal criteria for the government to end your life for you, to give you the assistance to end your life. And as to the why, part of it is that in Canada, there was, well, I'll give you a bit of history on this, because I think this would apply to Americans, and probably to Brits as well, but certainly to Americans. There is a judicial activism problem. We have judges that push ideological agendas. The former Supreme Court Chief Justice in Canada, Beverly McLaughlin, she had given this, when she wrote it in her, I think it was in her memoir. It might have been an interview or it was in her memoir. I can't remember which. But she had given this line that has stood out with me, which is that she said what her job was as a judge was to listen to the arguments, then go back into chambers and figure out what's best for society. Now, she was saying this as a very deliberate explanation of how she views her job as a judge. Not to view what the law says and review what the law says, but to make a determination of what's best for society. Now, she's also someone who had lost her first husband to a terminal medical condition. And this part, for sure, she wrote in her memoirs, she said, influenced the way that she viewed MAID, the way that she viewed assisted suicide when it came before her on the Supreme Court. Again, she was being very explicit. This is the former Chief Justice of the Canadian Supreme Court, that she was letting her personal experiences with terminal illnesses influence the way that she viewed legally as a judge what was supposed to be a legal question. So that was a very brazen and explicit way of viewing this, this idea of judicial activism not being an incidental byproduct of just judges who are hacks, but judges that are quite proud of this, that say, you know, they believe that their activism is essential and central to their role as judges, as what are supposed to be impartial, objective observers and adjudicators of the law. So I think that's a part of why it's happening, is that we have judges that have basically taken over, and you also have an activist class beyond that that the government is beholden to. There is a very well-funded, well-organized group in Canada called Dying with Dignity that will not accept any concessions on assisted suicide. Any. One of the things they did when this last came up before the Supreme Court, like the day after the decision, they were already mounting their fight to push for a greater expansion. And that was what led to, of course, this expansion, this next bound to people who are dealing only with mental illnesses. So I think that's a part of it. I think the Canadian government does not value life. And they have also ceded so much decision-making authority to activists that do not value life and actively want a culture of death in this country. And I think that's why the MAID program in Canada, to use the euphemism for a moment, is going to continue to balloon in size and scope. And people are going to end their lives and not be able to come back from it just because they were sold a bill of goods by medical practitioners that are heavily invested in this as well, that are part of that activist class. Frank Gallenstein or Gallenstein writes, "Hi, Andrew, my wife and I, along with another couple who have been good friends with me and my wife for the past 50 plus years, are planning a trip to Newfoundland in the July timeframe with stopover day trips on the way there to Niagara Falls and coming home to Portland, Maine. Anything coming from Trudeau lately we should watch out for that might restrict on our freedom or result in jail time? Well, if you're coming in July, you might have to worry about the online hate speech bill, which I'm happy to talk about if anyone asks a question. Actually, I hope someone does ask a question about the online hate speech bill, because this was one that has a very direct tie into Mark Stein, who you may have heard of. He's the namesake of Stein Online. But so that bill may come, so you may have to watch what you say online in July. Anything else? I don't know. I mean, if you donate, if there are any trucker protests, Frank, try not to donate or your bank account could be frozen. But as far as sights to see, so I have not actually spent that much time in Newfoundland. I was there for one night and about half a day when I was covering the 2021 election campaign. And we flew in, stayed overnight, and then did a photo op that we were reporting on the next day, and then flew out and went to, I think it was New Brunswick or Nova Scotia. So I've only done about, 4 hours of daylight in Newfoundland. It was a lovely 4 hours. We were up in Cornerbrook, which is northern Newfoundland, so I assume you're probably going to end up in St. John's. One area I have heard very good things about, though, is Fogo Island. So if you get the chance to go to Fogo Island, Frank, do check that out. I can give you more on Niagara Falls. Niagara Falls, stay away from the tourist trap of Niagara Falls itself. Go there, get your pictures, get the heck out. You want to go instead just down the way to Niagara-on-the-Lake. And there's one little inn there that I know Mark loves, which is the Prince of Wales. I have not stayed there, but I have a gift certificate to there that I've been meaning to use. So you may have given me the kick in the pants to go and redeem that. But Niagara-on-the-Lake, a lovely little town and not as kitschy as Niagara Falls, Ontario. And as for Portland, Maine, I've not been to Portland, Maine. I've only been to Bar Harbor on the first Mark Stein cruise, so I can't be of much help there. This is a question from Bill Decker, who writes, thank you for stepping in to keep the Clubland conversation going. I appreciate how you, Laura, and other hosts bring your own perspectives to the conversation. Earlier this year, Mark acknowledged the passing of musician Denny Lane. 2 days before Mr. Lane passed away, Canadian musician Miles Goodwin also left us. I'm old enough to remember when April Wine was regularly on Canadian radio and touring, along with many other, many other Canadian performers during the 1970s and 80s. My question is, do you think these bands would have done better or worse if there had not been Canadian content requirements to make space for them? Since the internet wasn't around, there were far fewer ways to hear these groups, and in hindsight, providing some level of protection against a very large and established American music system gave the Canadian bands a chance to grow. CanCon now seems a futile effort despite the recent federal attempts to restrict news and entertainment options for Canadians on the internet. So, okay, I have to apologize to people now because I was like jokingly earlier saying, hopefully we won't have too much Canadian content for you. And this is a question that is not just about Canadian content, but literally about Canadian content requirements. So the background on this is that I think it was in the 70s, might have been the early 80s, the government was concerned about exactly what Bill just describes there, which is this complete saturation of the Canadian cultural markets with American cultural exports. And obviously, there was a hugely developed American music industry relative to the industry in Canada, and the government wanted Canadian artists to be able to get radio airplay instead of just the American top 40, Billboard 100, whatever it was, artists. So they put this requirement in place that had a system by which a song classified as Canadian, and it was there was a designation called MAPLE, which was, I think, the music, the artist, the performance, and the lyrics. And two of the four had to be Canadian for it to be Canadian content. So if you were a Canadian artist, but the lyrics and music were written by an American and you performed it in America, you didn't count. But if you were a Canadian artist, or conceivably, you could be an American artist that performed in Canada and had a Canadian lyricist. And I believe Heart was taking advantage of this because they were in Washington State. And if I recall correctly, Heart had a number of its songs classed as Canadian content, and they actually got more airplay in Canada for a time than they did in the United States. But look, I'm a free market guy. But I'm sympathetic to the argument here that it would be harder for Canadian artists to break through when everyone is expecting the better funded and more famous American artists when they tune into the radio. And an interesting aside to this is that border radio stations, so radio stations in Vancouver or Windsor, Ontario, near the American border, they actually had a lower threshold of Canadian content because in those cases, they know that people could just as soon listen to an American radio station. So they were trying to preempt the fact that a lot of Canadians didn't actually want to listen to the crappy Canadian content that was being forced upon them, like it is to you now by me hosting this show. This is not a legal requirement, though. This is just, you know, Mark trying to foist Canadian content on you. But so absolutely, Bill, I think the bands would have done worse without Canadian content. And there would have been some artists that I don't think succeeded. Some would have broken through. Like a guy like Justin Bieber, I think, is going to succeed regardless just because he had come up through the internet and he got famous on YouTube and it didn't really matter as much that he was Canadian. Someone like Celine Dion, I mean, she got her start in a lot of ways on Eurovision. And she was, I believe, I forget the name of the song, but she was competing for Switzerland because Canada was not shockingly in Eurovision. And Celine Dion, I mean, would someone like her have gotten famous without Canadian content? Probably, but it's tough to say. What's interesting is that the government has now taken this Canadian content requirement for music, and they've tried to extend it to podcasts and YouTube videos. This was actually just within the last year. They passed a bill that is going to force YouTube and Netflix and all of these streaming services, including podcast registries, to have Canadian content on any content that people can offer. So they've actually taken the regulatory environment that was around the broadcasting world in Canada and have applied it to the internet, which I think will tremendously backfire. Thank you for that question. Steve from Manhattan, who was Mark's official doorman. He's a lawyer, but he was working humbly as Mark's official doorman in the D.C. court. And that's where I met him on the Mark Stein cruise, but I saw him again in the courtroom and saw him again on this most recent cruise. Steve from Manhattan writes, "Hello, Andrew. Thank you and the entire Stein team for another wonderful cruise. The sun and sea part is always a welcome distraction from the civilizational collapse aspect of the Steinian journeys. At last week's onboard book signing, Mark was kind enough to refer to me as his favorite Montenegrin brigand. This leads to my question. On the next Stein cruise, would it be possible to provide at least an introductory survival course, perhaps calling it Brigandry 101? If civilizational collapse is actually right around the corner, aren't we all going to need, in one quick hurry, some new skills?" Yeah, that's actually quite an interesting question. I'll bring your suggestion for a course to committee. I think Michelle Bachmann might be able to perhaps lead that course. She's an American. So Americans have been ahead of the rest of us on the whole prepping world. It's quite funny because I remember when it used to be actually a bit of a mocking point for people where they would basically see all these like Fox News viewers that were getting ads for meals ready to eat and gold and all of that and say, oh, you know, look at these losers with their, you know, prepping chambers and all of that. And it's funny now that the apocalyptic gloom and doom is all coming from the left. The left are the ones saying that we're all going to be in some climate apocalypse. So if you don't, you know, stock up on all of that stuff now, you probably won't be able to. And of course, you can't have your MRE in a single-use plastic. So you've got to, you know, buy your MREs in bulk, which I don't know how that's going to work out too well. But yeah, I do think perhaps some survival training might be quite good. I mean, I was always worried after the whole COVID thing that the Mark Stein cruise would end up like the Diamond Princess, where it just has to, you know, sail the world on end for, you know, months on months, just because that's the way it's being kept afloat, so to speak. But yeah, absolutely. So if anyone wants to volunteer with some tips and tricks for Brigandry 101, we will take them ahead of the 2025 Mark Stein cruise. Richard writes, "Andrew, I saw a GB News presenter give a fairly butch treatment to a family of Syrian groomers and rapists. Is this a one-off reporter straying from the reservation, or is there some thinking, some rethinking going on at GB News? So I didn't see the interview in question. I'm going based on your summary of it, and anyone who has seen this may wish to weigh in the comments. I take a view on GB News that is probably not all that surprising, as given my relationship with Mark, and that I think you can have individual people that are capable of doing and saying the right thing. But I think on balance, one thing that the GB News experience shows is that those people are invariably the ones that are shown the door. Now, is it just some grand coincidence that anyone who says things that are bold finds their way out? Or is, you know, again, maybe it is a coincidence. Maybe these people are all the ones that happen to have issues in their contracts, scheduling conflicts, and all of that. But I don't think that is the case at all. And I think, again, it's entirely good if GB News has decided to turn a corner on this. My experiences from what I saw either behind the scenes, and I've been a guest on GB News, and obviously I've worked with Mark, who had his show on GB News, is that they're far more focused on what you can't say and what you shouldn't say than what you can say and what you should. And that's true of their relationship with Ofcom. I know people have been following Mark's case with Ofcom. That is coming to court, I believe, in June. And one of the things that's so fascinating about this is that whenever I have had experiences with regulatory bodies, which is sadly more than I wish I had, when I used to work in radio, the whole point is that the company would be your advocate to the regulator. The company would say, here is our case, here is our position. It's like hiring a lawyer. You want the lawyer who's going to explain the law to you and understand the law, but you want a lawyer who's going to go to bat for you using the law. And GB News' relationship with Ofcom was the opposite. They had an Ofcom rep who would try to be Ofcom's representative at GB News rather than GB News' Ofcom representative. And the thing that was so disturbing about that is that it meant that when you were trying to do what Mark was doing, which is having discussions that may have been outside, well, were certainly outside the mainstream of discourse in British media, what was happening was you'd end up with this guy who is supposed to be helping you navigate through the process that's instead saying, oh, no, you can't do that, you shouldn't do that, and taking the regulator's position. And again, imagine if you hired a lawyer and your lawyer didn't actually focus on prepping your case, but instead just told you all the things you shouldn't do when there was a case available to you. That was my read as a foreigner and an outsider to GB News. So yeah, if GB News did this thing well, great. I would say that a broken clock is right twice a day. And if it's more than that, all the better. But I'm not optimistic. We have a question from Penns Woods, who writes, Andrew, what are your thoughts on Canada? Oh, sorry, everyone. Reinstating visa requirements for Mexican nationals. So I don't have too many thoughts on it. Canada has had a border issue for the last several years on Roxham Road, which is this road connecting New York State and the province of Quebec. It is not an official border crossing, but it has become an illegal border crossing because it is so easy to just walk into Canada. So people that are facing deportation in the U.S. will fly to New York. They'll get in a taxi. The taxi will drive them to Roxham Road. They'll walk across the border. And then the RCMP on the other side will help them with their bags. And you think I'm joking. Literally, the police will help illegal immigrants with their bags and then take them to a processing center where they make an asylum claim and then Bob's your uncle. But what's been happening in the last little while is people from Mexico have been going the other way. They've been flying to Canada, flying to Montreal, and going south. And it's been angering the United States because this is becoming a U.S. problem. And one of the reasons for it was that Canada didn't have a visa requirement for people from Mexico. So anyone could just say they're coming to Canada as a tourist and then make an asylum claim in the U.S. when they get here. So Canada finally reinstated the visa requirement. I think it's long overdue, and I don't suspect it will last. But I think Justin Trudeau was uninterested in securing Canada's borders. I think he only wanted to do the visa requirement when Joe Biden started getting mad at him, and that was all it took. Matt from upstate New York. Matt actually might be one of those Mexican visitors that landed in Montreal and then went over to upstate New York. Who knows? Or he's on his way to Roxham Road to claim asylum in Canada. But he writes, I've seen many on the left throw around the idea that the right, especially under Trump, subscribes to the idea of Christian nationalism. I'm on the right. Did I miss the memo? I'm completely in the dark. What on earth is Christian nationalism anyway? Ooh, this is a big question. So, I mean, Christian nationalism, anytime nationalism or Christianity are said by the media, it's almost always as a negative. So Christian nationalism in that sense is just a double whammy. To take two things they hate and expect everyone else to hate and throw them all together in one term. It's hard to define it because it is used in so many ways inconsistently by people. Like in Canada, there were concerns about Christian nationalism because you had Christian groups that were just trying to get involved in politics. It was actually... Sorry, I had to cough there. I didn't want you to, you know, have your eardrums blown out. But you had Christian groups that were saying they were frustrated with COVID. They were frustrated with their churches being locked down. They were mobilizing and engaging with politics. And then you had people in the media saying this was this dangerous importation of Christian nationalism from the United States. And then you've got people that anytime a political leader says something markedly related to faith or religion or the church, they're accused of trying to muddy the so-called separation of church and state, which is itself quite misunderstood and misrepresented by a lot of people. But I think you're basically being told that if you're a Christian, you're supposed to just completely hide and conceal that from all aspects of your life. I think that's the what's at the thrust of a lot of these attacks on so-called Christian nationalism. Olga from Arizona, who I believe I met on the Mark Stein cruise, if she's the Olga I'm thinking of, she writes, Hi, Andrew. Yes, she was. It was super cool to meet you live and in person. We were wondering if your show is available on podcast so we can catch up on Canadian content. Well, yes, if you want more, the Andrew Lawton Show is available and you can catch that in video form at True North, which is www.tnc.news. And you can also check it out just by looking in your preferred podcast app under The Andrew Lawton Show. And I thank you very much for your interest. And yes, it was lovely meeting you last week, Olga. Toby Pilling writes, I don't have much in common with gorgeous George Galloway, but did find his observation that Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer are two cheeks of the same backside quite accurate. Would you agree? I think in a lot of ways I would, and I believe there was something in between that. I can't remember, but Michael Meagan, who was one of the Mark Stein cruisers, had said there was an end to that quote, which is that they're two cheeks of the same backside, and it's the same stuff that comes out between them, I believe was the rest of that quote. I've got very little time for George Galloway. I've got no time for his position on the Middle East. I have got little time for his position on Russia. I, generally speaking, find him to be an utterly contemptible person. But, you know, just like we were talking about with GB News, you could have a broken clock being right twice a day. I think that, you know, what's interesting here is that you have a guy who is clearly outside the mainstream of politics. He's outside the mainstream of society. And I think that there are a lot of people that are so fed up, rightfully so, with the mainstream, that they flock to people like Galloway, I would say, not even out of agreement with them, but just because they're someone who's not like everyone else. And I think there's a danger to that. You may remember I was, and am, very skeptical of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for that reason. You could look at a guy like RFK Jr. and say, I agree with him on this issue or I agree with him on that issue. But that doesn't mean you have to look at him as your messiah, which I find a lot of people on the right tend to do too much, whether it's to Kanye West or Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Naomi Wolf to some extent as well. So it's one thing to have allies and to say, I can agree with you on this and disagree with you on that. It's another thing to say, I'm going to, you know, hitch myself to this person. And to be fair, I'm setting up a straw man in some way, because I'm not saying everyone's doing that with George Galloway. But just because he's right that everyone else is crap doesn't mean he's right about the things that he wants to do in lieu of what they want to do. And I think he can be wrong for different reasons. And I guess that would be my my final verdict on George Galloway there. Gregory Lawton, not an L-A-W-T-O-N. He's an L-A-U-G-H-T-O-N, but we won't hold that against him. Any thoughts on whether Jill Biden makes that call to a place for mom on behalf of sleazy Joe Biden before the convention? Well, I think it's clear at this point that Biden is not going anywhere. Certainly Biden's not going anywhere because he can't find his way to go anywhere. Biden couldn't go anywhere because he would get lost there. But I mean, he's not leaving the White House. And I think everyone's fine with the idea of a marionette suspended Joe Biden being president. I think Jill Biden is probably the one who stands the most to gain from this because she's the one that gets to pull the strings and tell him where to walk and whisper into his ear. And it's actually like those movies where someone is under a deep hypnotic spell because someone has been whispering commands into them the whole time. I mean, that could be Jill Biden. So she could wield her power responsibly or irresponsibly, but I don't think she's going to call the place for mom because I think she gets to be the shadow president for the next 4 years. If they can just get through the next, what is it? We're in March now. So if she can just get through the next eight months, she is golden. Keith Farrell writes, Andrew, between Super Tuesday, Fannie Willis, Ofcom, and GB News in the UK budget, you could that he wrote Noose, by the way, not GB News. You could do with 2 hours, Andrew. My question, the Office for Budget Responsibility. Well, there's an office that clearly has no value. Forecasts the record 2.8 million people off work with long-term health problems are about to be joined by more people in the same boat. Allied to the evident excess deaths, is it time for Mark's formal response to Ofcom to be told you so? Well, I think Mark's response to Ofcom has been, I told you so. I mean, to go back to the Michael Mann suit for a moment, one of the things that I found quite admirable about what Mark did was not hiding behind the First Amendment. He didn't wave his Constitution in the jury's face. Not that with that jury in D.C. it would have done him many favors. But he said time and time again, I stand on the truth of what I wrote. I stand on the truth. It's not just that it was my opinion and I'm wrong, but he said, I stand on the truth. And he's been doing that in his Ofcom case. Obviously, the stakes are different. It's more of a legal question that you're trying to pursue against or with a judge, not against a DC jury that has a precarious relationship with time and punctuality. But, well, no relationship with punctuality in the case of that jury. But he said something very similar, which is that he stands on the truth of what he said on air. It wasn't just that he had a right to his opinion. It was that he believed in what he was saying. So I think in that sense, absolutely, it is something that we're going to be seeing far more of. We have a question here from Harold Emmons Jr. A nation can't survive without secure borders, considering that millions of unvetted people have illegally entered the USA and the existence of other variables. Are we witnessing the eventual destruction of our democratic republic? Well, it's your democratic republic, Harold, not mine, but I think I can still take a stab at the question. I think that's been in motion for quite a while now. The idea of just a profound reshaping of what the United States is. And look, a country that has no borders doesn't really have much at all. It doesn't really have anything because at a certain point, you're deciding that the fundamental role that a country has, that a government has, which is territorial integrity and sovereignty, once you've decided that does not matter to you, you've decided that you don't actually care what happens within your borders. And this is something, no matter how libertarian you are, and I'm always accused of being too libertarian in some circles, but no matter how libertarian you are, you can still believe that your country's borders must be protected because it is only through protecting your borders that you could have the model society within them that you want. You can't have a libertarian society if you don't have national sovereignty that is going to constrain what the state is able to do. Because once security risks are running rampant, it is very easy for governments to start trampling on civil liberties. You can't have any sort of, well, I'll take this in two directions. Number one, you can't have any real control in the future of your country if you aren't controlling your borders. Because again, the fundamental relationship you have with your people to keep them safe, is not actually being delivered. So whether it's going, I mean, it depends what you mean by eventual destruction. I mean, it doesn't need to be a country in flames for the America that you know to be fundamentally and irreparably changed. And I'd say it's not, you know, the immigrants to the United States that are causing the problems. It's the people that are deciding and have decided that they don't care about borders that are the ones that could do something about this and should directly be blamed for it. We have a question here from Nicola Timmerman. I can't write. I'm not going to read that one. It's speculating about very unpleasant things. But Ming the Merciless, that's, of course, Klaus Schwab, says, there were many an interesting discussion over dinner during the cruise. One I remember was the issue of contemporary Americans maybe not being treated fairly on the basis of their political leanings, ethnicity, or even gender by the courts. Bureaucracy, employers, etc. One has to keep perspective. It was stated, and remember how much worse things were in this regard, particularly for Black Americans so many years ago. There was, for instance, that awful Dred Scott case when Chief Justice Taney couldn't bring himself to recognize that Black Americans had rights that others were bound to respect. Even after the Civil War, there were times and places that a Black citizen could not even count on the law to protect his very person, when lynching was practiced sometimes with impunity, and even cases that went to trial were overturned by jury nullification. Thankfully, that monster state of affairs is long dead, no matter what BLM may honk, and today's Americans are much more secure under the law. But will it always be so? That's a very difficult question, because you're asking, you're basically saying in the question that things were bad in these many key ways, which I agree with, and now they are largely better in these key ways, which I think is true. And no one's claiming that racism doesn't exist, but this general idea of equality before the law was something that we achieved. And this was true in common law jurisdictions. It's been true going back to when the British Empire sought the abolition of slavery, when you saw civil rights era reforms and all of this. But the critical part is that we've seen in the last decade in particular, but you know, beyond that, the last generation, this overcorrection where equality before the law is no longer desirable. Martin Luther King, whatever people may think of his politics, he was very clear that what he wanted was equality before the law. What Martin Luther King Jr. was advocating for was not what passes for racial advocacy now, which is special treatment, affirmative action, critical race theory, DEI, all of these things that have shown equality is not only not the goal, but equality is now being held up as some white supremacist, right-wing, racist concept, where if you advocate for equality, if you advocate for that colorblind society, that Kingian colorblind society, that you are part of the problem and you're simply trying to uphold white supremacy and all the like. So it won't always be so. And I think that right now it's clear that we need to start calling out what is being advocated for by people. And one of the big things you should always be on guard for is when equity becomes the goal more than equality. And equity is basically equality of outcome instead of equality of opportunity. And increasingly, equity is seen as being desirable. Equality is seen as being specifically undesirable. Suzanne writes, I'll take the bait, Andrew. Well, thank you for that. What's your point of view regarding Canada's online hate bill? Well, I mentioned the Mark Stein connection to this. So you may recall back in 2006, Mark published this book called America Alone. Very, very influential book around the world, Canada, the UK, Australia, the US. There was an excerpt published in Maclean's magazine where Mark wrote a column. And this excerpt was published and then quickly became the subject of human rights complaints. Now, one of the cudgels used against it was the so-called Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act, which was a bill that made it a human rights offense in Canada to pass off content that was likely to incite hatred, And this was the bill that or the provision of law that was used to go after people like the late Kathy Schadl. It targeted conservative bloggers largely. It was a profoundly pro-censorship section of human rights law. Mark fought it. Ezra Levant fought it. Kathy Schadl fought it, and they ended up defeating it. The conservative government in 2013 had repealed this, Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act, and it was so important that they did. And, of course, none of this stays dead for long. So what the Liberal government under Justin Trudeau has now been doing for the past 8 years that it's been there, 9 years now, is trying to bring this back. And they have finally, as of last Monday, introduced this bill. It's called Bill C-63. It's the Online Harms Act. It's a bill that will reintroduce Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act, will make it illegal to pass off so-called hate speech online, which they define as speech that is likely to foment detestation and vilification. And they try to couch it in all these terms to say, oh, but we're not going to censor you because, you know, just because it's offensive or disdainful or harmful or hurtful, that doesn't mean it's illegal. It has to cause detestation and vilification. That's the line they've drawn. So your speech has to be more than disdainful, and it has to rise to the point of breeding detestation, which is all going to come down to the subjectivity of the Canadian Human Rights Commissar that picks up the case. Now, there are also instances here where you could file a complaint, and if the government finds against the person about whom you complain, you get $20,000, even if you weren't harmed. So if someone doesn't like something I say on my show, they can file a human rights complaint, and then I'm out $70,000 because I have to pay up to $20,000 to the person and $50,000 to the Receiver General of Canada. And again, this is all being done to supposedly make the internet a less harmful place. This is a bill that's been directly influenced and inspired by the UK Online Harms Bill, by Australia's e-safety positions. The US has been generally better on these issues, although the tech companies themselves have caused some of the problems. It is an absolutely disgusting and despicable piece of legislation, and it is exactly why that old line of Marx is so important, that when liberals win, they're in power, and conservatives win, they're in office, because a conservative government can come in, get rid of this bill, everyone says, great, we've killed censorship, and then you blink and the liberals have brought it back. Brian from Minneapolis writes, Dear Andrew, why does the West play by a different set of rules than the rest of the world? Israel-Gaza is a prime example of this. No one argues Hamas attacked, kidnapped, raped, and killed Israelis, yet Israel is accused of genocide. Why do we fall into the trap of having to allow our societies to become the very ones that teach such hate towards Israel? Surrendering our values for those who wish to destroy us hasn't worked out anywhere in the Western world, but they insist this is being welcoming. What say you, Andrew? Well, I think you're right about the core problem, Brian, and it's quite devastating. I mean, we have always, in the cultural relativist sense, taken this view that who are we to say that, you know, our culture's better, our beliefs are better, our way of life is better? And the inevitable byproduct of that, the inevitable consequence of that, is a society in which we can't actually call out the rape of Israeli girls and women. We can't actually call out the murder of Israeli civilians because we've said, oh, well, they're being oppressed. They're victims of colonialism. Who are we to judge? Judith Butler, who's that absolute academic nutcase, had said yesterday that this was basically armed resistance. Well, the clip went around yesterday. I don't know when she said the comments, but she was basically saying, yeah, anything Hamas did, it was all resistance. It was an uprising. So, you know, we have to shrug our shoulders because the left is holding firm to this paradigm that it's created where colonialism is bad, so anything they brand as colonialism is bad, and anything that's done in response to colonialism is therefore justified. So, you know, if Hitler were to stage another Holocaust today, he would just have to come up with a way to say that it was an exercise in post-colonial struggle, and the left would have to find it to be completely hunky-dory okay. And that is disgraceful for me to have to come to terms with, that I believe that, and that I know that to be true. That you could sell the Holocaust today by claiming it's some post-colonial struggle, and there would be pockets of academia that would be completely okay with that. And that is absolutely devastating. And to your point about why the West has fallen into that trap, I think it is because of that embrace of cultural relativism. It is because there has been this unwillingness to accept that other people can be savages and that you could look at barbarians that want to rape and torture and kill civilians, and that you're not allowed to say that savage, that you have to say, oh, but well, you know, colonialism and all that, like that to me is disgraceful. And you look at the UN, finally, this week, the UN has come out and said, okay, it looks like there might have been evidence of sexual assault. And what are the people now saying? The people that originally went the truther route, originally the Hamas apologists were saying, oh, there's no evidence, this didn't happen, no, they didn't behead a child, they didn't assault women, they didn't do this. But now that this has happened, they'll just change it. It'll be like, okay, well, can you blame them? Well, this is what happens in war. Well, this is what happens when you're pushed to the brink. That's going to be the justification. So there is no both sidesing the Israel issue. There is no both sidesing this at all. Mark Lipniaki writes, greetings, Mark. Well, not Mark, but I'll try to do my best here. Knowing Boris Johnson as you do you think there's any substance to the accusations leveled against him by Tucker Carlson? I'm assuming this is in reference to Tucker Carlson saying that Boris Johnson wanted $1 million to be interviewed by him, which I think is an absolutely hilarious story. So Boris Johnson and Tucker Carlson have, you know, had this war of words on things in the past, I think on Russia. And Tucker said, hey, why don't you just come on my show? And had tried a few times, apparently, to no avail, and then reached out to a, I don't know if it was a mutual friend or someone that Tucker knew that was very close to Boris Johnson. And Tucker claims that Boris Johnson then turned around, or this guy said, all right, yeah, he'll do it, but you need to pay him $1 million for the privilege of interviewing him. I actually think this is entirely believable from everything I know about Boris Johnson. He's actually speaking at a Canadian event that I'm going to be speaking at in a few weeks. And I certainly hope they're not paying him $1 million, because I'm certainly not getting $1 million for being there. But I think it would be entirely in character. Now, Boris Johnson has denied this, so I don't know if it's just like blaming the staffer, blaming the help, or what's going on here. But I wouldn't be surprised on that one at all. Leo VT writes, hi, Andrew. Sorry we missed the cruise this year. Sounds like it was another rollicking time. A quick note to Frank G. Niagara Falls is one heck of a side trip to Newfoundland. I would recommend the Maid of the Mist or Hornblower boats to the foot of the falls. Best way to feel the falls. Yeah, make sure you wear your poncho if you do that, Frank. My question, similarly to the UK, in Canada, we are seeing pro-Palestine protesters bullying the police forces into submission. Is there a way to fix this? Or are we too far gone? So I think yes and no, there is a way to fix it. I think to diagnose the problem, one of the big issues we've had here, and this has been, I think, tremendously dangerous, is that police have basically taken the view that you can never antagonize the left. And part of this is self-preservation. They don't want the inevitable bad press that's going when one police officer misgenders someone or roughs someone up a little bit too much in an arrest. I think there have been examples of police getting very deserved criticism for the way they handle people. But they've overcompensated for that by basically saying, we will never say or do anything that is going to alienate or offend left-wing protesters. Right-wing protesters is fine, because they're all, violent right-wing extremist powder kegs. But left-wing protesters, police won't do anything about. So now that you have people that are on the streets quite literally endorsing terrorism in a lot of ways, police have taken the capitulation route. And I've spoken to officers. I know for a lot of these people, it is that they are getting their marching orders from above. It's not that they're themselves shills for Hamas by any stretch. It's that they're being handcuffed, pardon the pun, by the powers that be above them. We have time, I think, for one more question here. We'll go to this one from Idaho Bob, who writes, welcome back to the saddle, Mark. We've missed you. Well, apologies. I'm not actually Mark, but I enjoyed your assessment of the U.S. military yesterday, though you could have widened the focus to include their green energy initiative. Who knew you could move a military with solar panels and heavy fire-prone lithium batteries? So our military isn't serious, and they struggle with recruitment. Would you agree this is a reflection of a broader economic problem? Our institutions and private companies suffer the same derangements. Executive focus is increasingly devoted to DEI, ESG, and climate change. Between early retirements, quiet quitting, and a simple lack of motivation to support these initiatives, my sense is that our productivity is collapsing. A comment I've heard frequently is, if our executive management isn't serious about the business, why should I be? I think you're right to some extent, although I wouldn't make it purely economic, because I think the economics are downstream of the culture. You look at the employee issues you've talked about here. I mean, I'm responsible for hiring journalists in my capacity as managing editor of a news organization. And I will say that the quality of applicants is absolutely abysmal in a lot of cases. You find the diamond in the rough and you pounce on them. But the problem increasingly, and I've talked to other people that have hired for whatever positions, whether it's general labor or construction or manufacturing, I mean, very high paying jobs, and they just can't find people that are willing to work them. So they end up hiring people that don't really care, but they can't replace them. So they deal with just lackluster, inadequate employees. And it's really disheartening when you see that applied to the military, which we all, I think rightfully so, want to hold up as being the, you know, the best of the best. And we want to believe that the best people are putting on uniforms. And clearly they deserve to be commended for doing so. But in Canada, just to bring it back to that for a moment, they've had to continuously drop the standards of dress because it's the only way they're going to, in their view, be able to have recruits. So you can now in the Canadian Armed Forces have a face tattoo. You never used to be able to have a face tattoo, but now you can. Now, is the reason because the Canadian Armed Forces decided that a face tattoo was actually a good thing to have? Or is it because they're just so dismal in their recruitment numbers that they just went through the list of things they've used to disqualify people and just started Xing things off? It's obviously that. Now, I would say that that makes people less likely to want to be in the military. When you have standards dropping, you look in there and say, well, I don't know if I want to be in that brigade. I don't know if I want to be in that world. And it's the same as DEI stuff. When you look and see that the university is going woke, I don't know if you saw this week, there was, I forget which division it was, but they sent around a note saying that famous photo of VJ Day of a sailor kissing a woman in Times Square, you can't do that anymore. You can't show that photo anymore. That photo is no longer permitted in the Defense Department in the U.S. And that you see and say, how on earth is anyone going to want to put on a uniform when the wokeness has infiltrated to the highest levels? So I think it's economic, yes, but it's also cultural. And I think that you can't solve the economic aspect unless you solve the cultural aspect. Well, I figured I couldn't find my file of Canadian Sunset, which I usually use as the outro music when I guest host the Q&A. So I decided that in the absence of that, I would lean into one of Mark's favorite criticisms of me after a guest hosting stint I did in the summer that he has not let me live down. So we'll send you out to the dulcet tones of Aqua. But this is Andrew Lawton in for Mark. We will see you next time.
Hiya, Bobby.
Hi, Ken.
You want to go for a ride?
Sure, Ken.
Jump in.
I'm a Bobby girl. In the Barbie world, life in plastic, it's fantastic. You can brush my hair, undress me everywhere. Imagination, life is your creation.
Come on, Barbie, let's go party.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.